You're listening to the Denver Real Estate Investing Podcast, where it's all about helping you grow your Denver real estate portfolio. Here's your host, Chris Lopez.
Hey, welcome back to another podcast episode. My name is Chris Lopez, and this is going to be the sixth and final episode in the Investment Property Analysis course. So this one's actually a case study on when I just recently pulled out a big chunk of change from my own primary residence. So I'm going to go through the numbers, my decision-making process, what I'm going to do with the money, and what type of returns that I can expect from it. So I will be referencing concepts and topics from the previous episodes. So if you've not listened to those, I definitely recommend you listen to those. And this would be a good course to go out there and just start from one, then go two, three, four, five, and then come to this episode, which is number six, because all these concepts do build on top of each other. All right. So here's the rundown on my situation here. So in November of 2019, I just closed out on a cash out refinance on my primary residence to pull out $106,000 and change. So that actually increased my monthly mortgage payment by $480. So for my previous existing mortgage, then once I did the cash out refinance, I have now an extra payment of $480,000, but I also have $106,000 sitting in my savings account right now to go out there and buy rental properties with. So that's the high-level overview. Now I'm going to go through and just kind of walk you through the whole process about my situation, the numbers, and what I plan on doing with the money. So when it comes to doing a cash-out refinance, whether it's on your primary residence or a rental property, you need to determine the amount of equity. Now, oftentimes, that's a pretty straightforward thing to do, especially on the property for a few years. You can see how much you have left in your loan balance. And if it's a pretty standard property, a condo, a single family home, a lot of times you can, you kind of know the feel or the ballpark value of the property based on sales around there, or just spending a few minutes on, one of the numerous websites out there to see some comps. And that can usually get you in the ballpark to say, oh, wow, I've got maybe $100,000 or maybe $200,000 worth of equity. Well, determining the amount of equity in my house was trickier than most people's. And that's because I think many of you know this, but some of you do not, is that I'm actually house hacking by having my wife's mother live with us. And we are doing that to help reduce living expenses, namely daycare for our little ones. Plus, there's some other savings we get in there, but just the daycare savings itself can be a couple thousand dollars a month. And a couple thousand dollars a month is a large percentage of my budget. So that is some significant savings there. So when we bought our house a while ago, we couldn't find an existing house that met all of our requirements that had an existing mother-in-law suite. So instead, we bought a big home and we bought one with a walkout basement with the idea that we could remodel it into a mother-in-law suite. So our original budget for remodeling was about $75,000. But surprise, surprise, with scope creep, we end up spending about $100,000 total on the basement remodel. Now, a few thousand dollars, that was just some other, small projects around the house that we were just doing since we had all the tradespeople over. But, I mean, $95,000 of that was for the basement. So just to verbally paint you a picture, the basement is just over 1,400 square feet. It now has a full kitchen, and it's a big, nice kitchen, has a living room, a nice open concept, has a master bedroom. We dug out an egress window in there, has a nice master bath, and has a guest bedroom. And so, the finishes on here are very nice, much, much nicer than your standard rental grade finishes. And a lot of the finishes are nicer than the, our section of the house, which is on the upstairs part of the house. So it's just, it's a nice higher end type of finish. And that's, a big reason why our budget did go up. So a little background, the finances on there, because I'm sure a lot of people are curious about that. So from our perspective, and I say that for me, my wife, and my mother-in-law's perspective, she did not want to have monthly mortgage payments, wanted to minimize her, monthly expenses, because she's now retired and is on a fixed monthly income like many retirees. And the main goal, me and my wife's, was to not have to outlay a huge chunk of cash. I'd rather minimize cash out of pocket and have higher expenses, but keep all that cash in the bank so I can have an emergency fund and then use that money to go out there and invest. So the way it worked out was my mother-in-law sold her previous home. And this is a home, you know, her and her husband bought, you know, back in the 80s in California. So they had some nice proceeds from there. And she took the proceeds from there to help fund the remodeling. And then going forward, we take care of all the ongoing costs, maintenance, you know, routine stuff, and of course, the mortgage. So that's a little background on our situation. And I'm sharing that with you just to give you the perspective we're in. And also to let you know that, you know, selling the property and moving out or turning the place into a rental or nomading or any of that stuff, it's off the table. For the amount of money we spent in the house and with our unique living situation where we can have family live with us, which is great from a, you know, just an overall family perspective, you know, we have no plans of moving from this property for a very, very long time. But with that said, you know, we bought this property a couple of years ago. We've put a big chunk of money in there, and we have made a gorgeous mother-in-law suite. Well, guess what? How many comps do you think I find out there on RE Colorado, which is our local MLS? I found about zero. There's just because there's no other houses that size with that type of mother-in-law suite, or at least anything that I could find. Perhaps other people have done it, but maybe they were like me where they bought the house, they did it. But there's no public record of it to determine sales or value. So trying to find good comps for me to ballpark what equity we might have in there was just impossible for me to do. I could pull up bigger houses with similar size bedrooms and compare, but still, that's just not a great apples to apples comparison. So oftentimes, like I said, you can, you know, pull some comps yourself off the, you know, various websites out there, or an agent can run you a comparative market analysis or CMA to help give you an idea about what the sales, the value of the property may be. But since I'm doing a cash out refinance and I'm not selling the property, who determines the value of the property? It's not me. It's not you, you know, you or the market. End of the day, it's the appraiser, because there's no buyer and seller in the situation where, hey, I want this amount and the buyer's willing to pay X amount. There's not that situation. It's just an appraiser comes in here and says, oh, the house, based on all these conditions, is now worth this. And generally speaking, spending $100,000 in upgrades does not directly translate into a $100,000 value increase. So, and just the hard rule of thumb, you know, for every dollar you spend, you're not going to see that dollar increase the value proportionately. A lot of times home upgrades give you a pretty poor return on investment when it comes from a value standpoint. So, you know, we spent roughly $100,000. So my thinking was, even if I got 50 cents on the dollar that we spent, I could still pull out some money to invest in, and that might make sense. So between some market appreciation for a couple years, between some value that we've increased, and, you know, we didn't get like an amazing deal on the property, but I think we got a few dollars below fair market value when we bought the property, because it was a property that had been sitting on the market for, I mean, like 5 months. So just, you know, they started out way too high, price drop. And then when I came in and offered them, it was definitely quite a bit lower than where they were still sitting at. But I also gave them a very favorable contract because the previous sellers or previous owners were waiting for a new build to finish. And, you know, they had a rough closing date and move-in date. So I said, hey, great. You know, I'll go and close on the place, you know, after the standard 30 days, but you guys can have a 60-day rent back for free. So I made very favorable terms, and that was one way I could also, you know, get the purchase price lower because it made their life easier. So not a huge screaming deal, but I think a couple thousand dollars, you know, maybe $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 below fair market value. So my thinking was, great, I probably saved a few bucks on the front end. I've got some market appreciation, and we did put some money in the property. And hopefully between these three things, I can pull some money out and go invest. So I called up Joe Massey at Castle & Cook and started talking to him about the cash out refinance process. Because until this was the first ever cash out refinance I have done. So I was getting all the details from him. And one of my main concerns was, hey, I really have no idea what my house is going to appraise for. So if I start the process, what are my hard costs if I, you know, if the appraisal doesn't come in at what I want and the numbers just don't make sense? So he said the only hard cost you have is the appraisal itself. So if we start the process, fill out the application, do all that stuff, and I pay the $600 for the appraisal, the appraisal comes back and it's below what I wanted in order for it to make sense for me to do the cash out refinance, pay the closing costs and restart the whole, you know, all the hassle of doing a new loan. Cool. I'm out $600. So that was going to be my sunk cost. So for $600, I'm like, great. Worst case scenario, $600, not a big deal. I'm not going to sweat it. And roughly I had about the $700,000 mark as my threshold for making it worthwhile for me to do a cash out refinance. Because at about a $700,000 valuation, I figured I could probably pull out about $80,000 or so. I was like, all right, that's enough for me to go out there and buy a rental property or rental property and then some. And that's probably worth it for me. So if it came in below $700,000, and of course, I was going to, you know, run the numbers no matter what the appraisal came in. But mentally, I was like, all right, it has to come in around $7,000 or higher. And based on the comps I could see and just kind of guessing everything, I gave it a greater than 50% chance that I would be at $700,000 or higher. So I was like, great, $600, that's nothing. Let's pull the trigger and see how it goes. So started the paperwork, paid for the appraisal, and then... had the appraiser come out. Now, I'm an agent, so I probably see way more appraisals than the average listener or the average investor out there. And just, you know, here's one of the interesting things about appraisals. I could have three different appraisers come out to my property or any property, and they'll all three do their reports, and they can all three come back with different valuations, but all three of them are correct. So an appraiser is just giving his or her expert opinion based on their knowledge and available data. So a lot of this, when an appraiser appraises a property, a lot of times they're calling agents who sold the comps that they're trying to use, try to get more specifics on the property and more nuanced data. They're also using MLS data. They're using data from appraisal resources. And a lot of times appraisers just have their own data that they accumulate over years and years and years as far as how to, you know, adjust pricing, and they're using that data. So a lot comes into here, and I'm sharing this with you to understand that if appraiser one, appraiser two, and appraiser three comes out, that there's a really good chance you're going to see three different valuations. So I scheduled the appraisal for when I could be home to make sure I could walk the property, answer the questions of the appraiser, and also just give them all the information. Since, you know, I always put myself in the other person's shoes. I'm assuming that the appraiser is a busy person. You know, like a lot of people, they're trying to gather the data, do the best thing. So the better data I can give them on the house and the more information I can give them, the more accurately they can price the property. And in this case, I'm hoping, you know, that will give us a higher valuation. So before the appraiser came over, I made copies of all the receipts, work orders, budget plans, upgrades, floor plans, just everything related to the remodel, plus those other couple odds and ends that we have done during the remodel and just other things that we put on there, or we did that we've done to the house while we live there. And so my goal was to provide as much data as possible so you could accurately value my house. And I made copies, put them together, and they were his to take when he left. So when he goes home, he's got the numbers, he's got the figures, and that can definitely help them justify a higher appraisal amount. Because, oh, great, you spent this amount of money. It's this quality finishes. It's this, it's this, it's this. So they can go out there and accurately appraise it. So I think the appraiser there was there at my house for probably a little bit over an hour. And that's probably a little bit longer than usual, but we got chatting about a few things. And also, I was just really curious because I just said, hey, I'm curious. How do you go about evaluating a property like this with the mother-in-law suite? Because as you know, there's going to be zero comps for this, at least that I've seen, using traditional appraisal comps where they want to use a very tight geographic radius and ideally in the last 3 months, maybe 6 months, maybe even 12 months, they'll go out. There just were no good comps. So one of the, you know, he said, yeah, it makes it challenging. But one of the interesting things he said is that one way they can value it to help give some anchor point to the valuation is that they can take the fact that, hey, it's a 2-1 basically apartment downstairs, and that, you know, what do they rent for in my part of town? You know, I could probably easily get $1,200 to $1,500 a month for it. So he said, hey, I'm going to go out there, see what going rents are, and I'm going to use a gross rent multiplier, or GRM, to help give a valuation to that unit downstairs. And that can be one of the things that can help justify a higher appraiser or help just give us some valuation to the property. Now, when it comes to doing residential, you know, single family homes, sales comps always, you know, take the priority from my understanding. And then the income approach, I forget the exact name, the third one, the cost to rebuild it. I don't know, that's not the exact title. They use those as well to help justify, but the sales comps are the biggest thing to do. So the GRM approach with the basement comes under the income approach. So I found that really interesting that they can actually use the basement, apply rents, and then use a GRM to go out there and help value that section and help increase the house, the value of the property. So if you don't understand what I'm talking about, so imagine there's two houses. And again, I'm down in Highlands Ranch. So just, you know, it's subdivisions and, you know, there's six styles of homes every, you know, 10 houses. But, you know, none with that mother-in-law suite. So, hey, get some similar houses, similar bedrooms, see what they sold for, then take the valuation from the GRM and help add that to the basement to increase the total valuation. So anyway, it was really fun and interesting to learn that from him. So gave him the details. We chatted. I pointed out features I thought were important. And a few days later, the appraisal came back to Joe. Joe forwarded it to me, and it appraised at $775,000. So I was very happy about that, and that was way above my $700,000 threshold to make the cash-out refinance worth it. So I was like, great, let's figure out some options as far as, you know, cash-out refi options, and then let's keep moving forward. So I'll walk you through the numbers that I've reviewed. So keep in mind, I'm not an expert at this, nor am I a lender. So make sure you talk to your lender or talk to Joe. He can help you out with this stuff as well. But I'll walk you through the numbers from my perspective to give you insight into it. So my existing mortgage balance was approximately about $430,000. So when you do a new cash out refinance, the way they do the math is they take out the new loan amount, then that has to pay off the existing mortgage minus any closing cost, and then the leftover is the cash that I get to take out. So the first thing I had to consider was a loan to value. How much a loan to value do I want to take out? So great, if the house is now worth $775,000, what percentage of that do I want to take out as a loan? So if you've read my investing strategy, you know that I'm a fan of maximizing leverage while holding high cash reserves to minimize risk. So same concept applies to here. I want to maximize the leverage to pull out money so I can go out there to invest. And so typically for rental properties and primary residence, that 75% loan to value ratio is the sweet spots for maximizing a cash out refi while also kind of getting the best interest rates and terms. So with rental properties, I've not seen a lender yet go above 75%. I'm sure there's some out there, but generally speaking, you're at 75%. But with primary residence, you can go above 75% and you can go up to an 80% loan to value option. But then if you go to an 80% loan to value option, you end up being it's a little bit riskier for the lender. So it's usually a higher interest rate. So looking at all the numbers, 75% loan to value was the way I wanted to go because that would give me a good chunk of cash to pull out of my equity, but also kind of give me the best interest rate. I could have done the 80% loan to value, but that extra 5% I could pull out did not justify the higher interest rate. Because that higher interest rate is not just being paid on that extra 5% difference, it's being paid on the total loan balance. So an extra, a few thousand dollars was not worth it. I forget the exact numbers, but when I talked with Joe, it just didn't make sense. So 75% was what I wanted to go forward with. So 75% of $775,000 is $581,250. So the next thing you have to take in consideration, or at least in my situation, was that the conforming loan limits for Douglas County is $561,200. So those conforming loan limits are the guidelines set by Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae as far as like what the total balance is that they will underwrite. I don't quite have all the details of that, but that's the gist of it. So if I did the full sitting 5% and went above that 561, which was an option, I'd be under a high balance loan, which again has a higher interest rate to it. So that higher interest rate was not worth it for me to pull an extra about $20,000. So I decided to go with that 75, or I'm sorry, the maxing out the conforming loan limit for Douglas County. And so that conforming loan limit for Douglas County of 561,200, that's pretty much the same for the counties in the Denver metro area. I can't specifically think for every single county, but when I've looked, 561,200 sounds right. Or give it a quick Google search and you can see it as well. So if I do the 561,200 max loan amount, that puts me at a 72.4% loan to value. So my initial thought was, great, I want to maximize at 75% loan to value. Oh, if I do that, I'm over the conforming loan limits. So I'm going to just take a few points off and maximize it to the conforming loan limits, because that was a sweet spot when I was looking at things as far as like maximizing the cash out of pocket while also keeping payments and interest rate in the sweet spot for me. So now that I've kind of got that first thing figured out, the next consideration was buying down the interest rate. So I told Joe to present me all the options he could for interest rates. And then what you can do with, you know, whether it's a refinance or a loan on a new home or new rental property, is you can buy the interest rate down. And what that means is when you're presenting the loan, you're given the interest rate. I think it's called the par interest rate. And then from there, you can pay extra money to buy the interest rate down. So you pay extra money up front to buy the interest rate down. So I have a table on the Denver Investment Real Estate website. I'll read it to you, or if you want to go check it out, just click the show notes and you can go there and see it. It's about, I don't know, about a third of the way down the blog post on here. So Joe presented me with four interest rates. The par one was 5.125, so 5 1/8. The next one was 4 3/4. The next one was 4 1/8. And the final one was 3 3/4 interest rate, or 3.75. So I'll kind of go through line item by line item so you can understand how all this impacts and what my payments would be and how much cash out I would get, because I was trying to find that, again, that sweet spot for my investing and also for my personal finance for paying a new monthly mortgage payment for the next 30 years. So the loan amount for all these is going to be $561,200. That stays the same. The closing cost for all four options, the estimated closing cost were $3,122. That remains the same for all four. And here's a breakdown of the closing cost. The processing fee is $745, and that's to Joe. The underwriting fee, $795, that's to Joe. Now, discount points to buy down the interest rate are technically part of the closing cost, but I'm putting that in a separate row so we can discuss those separately. The appraisal fee was $600, and actually I paid this directly, and this is one of the only, I think the only fee that came outside the closing table. A settlement fee from title, $240, and I have to get a new title insurance policy for the lender, $1,175. And then new recording fees to record the mortgage with the public records, $167. So about $3,100 there for closing costs. So across all four options, that stays the same. Now, escrow, this is me having to fund the escrow account when I get the new loan. And this is, I think it's like 6 months of taxes and 6 months of insurance, or, you know, 5 months of taxes and 3 months of insurance, something like that. I can't remember the exact amount. But it's $3,222, so about $3,200. And again, that's part of the closing costs. I just separate those out because I will pay that at closing, and then that money gets put into my mortgage escrow balance. Since the mortgage pays for, you know, my insurance and taxes, they want some money in there to go ahead and start paying for those items when they come due. So just as a side note here, since, you know, my taxes won't change. Oh, and just so you know, if you do a cash out refinance, that has no impact on your property taxes. And then my insurance stayed the same as well. So I already had a bunch of money built up in my previous escrow from my current loan. And I got the, you know, once that loan was paid off, I got a check back for that, which was $3,500 or $3,900. So, you know, that just came back to me in different forms. So, hey, great. I just get deposited in my savings account. So there's, you know, just a little FYI there. All right. So here's the interesting stuff. Going to discount points. So the discount points are what you pay to bring down the interest rate. So a point is equal to 1% of the loan value. So if I have a $100,000 loan amount, again, that's not purchase or value amount. That's the loan amount that you're getting. 1 point is equal to 1%. So 1 point of $100,000 is $1,000. So in my case here, that 5 1/8 interest rate, there's zero discount points because that's just the par rate. And then the next option at 4.75%, to get it there, I have to pay 0.75% discount rate, which is about $4,200. To get down to 4.125 or 4 1/8 interest rate, it's a 1.75% buy down rate, and that's about $9,800. And the last option of 3.75% was a 2.5% buy down, and that was about $14,000. So, you know, this would be money coming out of closing, and this is actually money that's going to reduce the amount of money I get from my cash out refinance. So I got my total loan amount of 561 and change, minus closing costs, minus escrow taxes, minus any discount points I pay, and minus my current loan, my loan balance. That's the amount of cash that I'll get paid at the closing table. So for that first option of 5 1/8, I'd walk with about $124,000, and my monthly P&I's, just principal and interest, not interest and not taxes and insurance. Because whether I do the cash out refinance or not, my taxes and insurance are the same. So I just wanted to see what my monthly P&I would be. So that for that first one, $124,000 cash out at about a $3,055 monthly payment. The next one at 4.75%, I'd walk with $120,000. My monthly P&I would be $2,927. At the 4 1/8 interest rate, my cash out would be $114,000 and change, and it'd be about $2,720 a month in a new monthly P&I. And the 3.75% option, I'd walk away with about $110,000, but my new payment would be just under $2,600 a month. So when I got this information, this definitely, I sat on this for a couple of days just to kind of marinate on it, think about it, run some scenarios before I gave Joe my answer back, because this is, you know, this is an important decision. And I was weighing on how much cash could I take out versus what my payment would be. And that, again, this is finding that sweet spot for the amount of cash I could take out. And then how much money do I feel comfortable with from a personal finance perspective for paying my new monthly insurance. So another way to take in consideration is the break-even period. And this is basically saying, oh, great, if I'm spending $4,200 to buy the interest rate down, that savings between the original monthly payment and the new monthly payment is X amount of dollars, how long does it take me to pay back that discount point in order to have, then start having it be make money for me? Excuse me. So for the, 5.18, 5 1/8 option, there's 0 months in break even since there's zero discount points. For 4.75%, about 33 months, so almost 3 years. For the 4.125% option, it's 29 months, so about, just under 2.5 years. And then for the 3.75% interest rate option, it was 31 months. So again, just about 2.5 years for a break even on there. So all these were about a 2.5 year break even. So I had the two things I was factoring in was, what do I want to keep my budget for my total monthly mortgage? And that is about $3,000 a month. And that's including principal, interest, taxes, and insurance. So I want to keep my payment as low as possible. And then how long will it take me to pay back the loan? Or how long do I plan on keeping the loan? Well, since I'm doing pretty much a max cash out refi, I don't think I'll be doing another cash out refi for a number of years, just because I don't think I'll have enough equity in my property to make it worthwhile. So two things, enough equity in my property, and then also I don't know how fast these conforming loan limits will go up every year. I just saw the new ones for 2020 before I was recording this, and I think they're at like 575 for this. They went up like $13,000 for 2020. So generally speaking, they go up every single year, But, you know, in 5 years, I don't know what that limit will be, nor how much equity I have. But I figure it's probably going to be a while since we're done the major upgrades and we're just going to pay it down. And I don't know how much more market appreciation we'll get for me to do another cash out refi, you know, in the near future. So my thought right now is that I will be holding this new loan for a long time, and I'll probably never do a cash out refi. I'll just eventually pay it off, or if we sell the property in 10, 20, 30 years, you know, we'll just pay it off then. So I'm planning on holding it for a long time. So with those two thoughts in mind, I wanted to keep my monthly payment as low as possible. So I went with a 3.75% rate option with that $14,000 point buy down. So in addition to my wanting to keep my total PITI payment to about $3,000 a month, I think it came out to like $3,100 a month is what it came out to be. So a little bit higher, but that fits within our budget as long as we can take this big chunk of money to go out there and invest it. So my original mortgage payment was $2,118. And so if I go with that 3.75% option, my new payment is about $2,600 a month. So it's a difference of $480 a month. So am I willing? So another way I looked at this is I'm willing to spend $480 a month for the next 30 years to get $110,000. Comparing that to the first option of a 5 1/8 rate buy down, that difference between my old mortgage payment and my new mortgage payment would be $937 a month for $124,000. So I would get an extra $14,000 out to max the cash out refi, but then I'm spending $937 a month for $124,000, or do I want to spend $480 a month for an extra $110,000? So for me to double my mortgage payment, or that difference in mortgage payment, is not worth it for me to get an extra $14,000. So hopefully that makes sense. There's a lot that goes on here, and this is just that balance of, hey, what do the numbers say? What's the opportunity cost of the money? And then what are you comfortable with from a mortgage balance wise? Plus another reason I wanted to do the lower payment was it just helps to keep our debt to income ratio lower. And so that way, as we finance new properties, we have a better debt to income ratio. So in the table, I estimate about $110,000 for cash out refinance. I actually walked away with $106,000, about $500. So why am I getting about $3,500 less? Well, that's because when Joe presented me the options, it was assuming a closing at the end of the month. We actually closed the following week at the beginning of the month. So I had a larger amount of prepaid interest. You know, it was like 28 days versus 2 days. And then in the estimates, the loan payoff for my actual mortgage was a little bit lower. It was a little bit higher when we actually closed and everything was said and done. So again, I don't care about a little bit difference there, because I want that. If I had $100,000 or more, I was really, really happy, or I am really, really happy. All right. So that is the breakdown of my house, the numbers I went through, and what I chose to do. So to recap that, just to help, because I know I'm going through a lot of numbers here, my payment went up from, about 21 and change to about 26 and change for my PI. So about $480 more dollars a month. So I could walk away with $106,000 today. So, you know, one of the reasons I want to do this cash out refinance was because I'm a big believer in that the sooner I get money in the market, or that's a stock market or real estate market, the more that compounding interest that I get. Just like we've all seen those articles and studies that the sooner you start saving in your 401k in your 20s, a 30-year-old or 40-year-old has to catch up by putting in, you know, 5 or 10 times the amount that you did in your 20s. So same concept here. The sooner I can put money into the market, I think the higher compound interest and the more money I'll make in the next, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50 years into my retirement. So now that I've got this cash, how am I investing it, and what type of numbers can I expect to get out of here? So I know a lot of investors, they just say, hey, great, if my cash out refinance monthly payment goes up $480, I need to see a rental property that pays me $481 or more in rental income. Now, that that thought process of having that rental cash flow be equal to or greater than the cash, my spread in my new mortgage payment, it's not a hard and fast rule for me. I have very few hard and fast rules. And part of that is just keep in mind is that rental cash flow is not everything, as we talked about in the first episode on the four ways you make money. The other thing is I will not be using cash flow for my rental property to pay the difference on my new higher mortgage. I keep our personal finances completely separate from our investing finances. All the money we make from investing, it goes towards buying more properties or buying more stocks and bonds. And then I take as hopefully as much as I can from our personal finances, and I shift it over to our investing bucket to go out there and buy more properties and more stocks and bonds. So I basically look at it as like, hey, for my personal finances, can I afford a $480 monthly loan payment in order to get $106,000 to invest now? And that works for our budget. Even if that means I put $480 less a month from our personal finances or investing finances bucket, I'm happy with that because, you know, for me to save up $106,000 at $480 a month, I don't know how long that is, but that's many, many, many years. So I'd rather have that money now. Plus, go beyond just the cash flow you make in the rental properties and think about what happens when you start optimizing your equity or your return on equity in the rental properties you buy, then you fast forward a few years down the road. So the cash flow and then me repositioning my equity to optimize it, as I talked about in that return on equity module with my Reno, Nevada condo, I expect that I can more than earn 3.75% of my money each year. I think I can actually keep it growing at 10% plus for 30 plus years, probably a little higher than that as well. So I'm very, very happy from the big picture. All right. So what am I going to do with $106,000? Well, at the time of this recording, I have not purchased anything yet. I'm just kind of wrapping up a few things for this year, and then I'll buy something here in quarter one of 2020. Plus, I need to see how much other money I've saved up. So I might figure out if I want to buy a multi-unit or buy a few small properties. I just need to get all my finances figured out. So I'm sitting on this money for a month or two. And I'm in no rush to invest it. So I'll get that done in quarter one. So what I did was to maximize cash flow, I'm just going to model buying two of the best cash flowing properties we see in Denver, which are those condos in Aurora. It's just 3-bedroom, 2-bathroom condos in Aurora that I've talked about previously. We talk about all the time on the podcast. So for simplicity's sake, I just I put two of the condos into one of Joe's spreadsheet, and I'll read the numbers here. And plus, that's the screenshot you see on the blog post. And so that's just to keep it really, really simple. So I double the purchase price, double the acquisition cost, double the rent, double the expenses to give it, you know, basically like, hey, I'm buying a duplex for these properties, but we're using these condo numbers. So they require a 25% down payment. And I said the purchase price is $200,000. And the acquisition cost and loan cost will be about $1,100 for both. So about $5,500 for each. So altogether, it's going to require a $100,000 down payment. And my total initial investment will be $111,000, $113,000, depending on the actual closing cost and some initial repair cost. So I have $106,000, and I'll probably spend, you know, $110,000 to $115,000 in this model. Great. I can make up that $5,000 to $10,000 difference. So mortgage rate, I'm assuming it'll be around a 4.5%, or I might buy the rate down a little bit. So it'll be a 30-year mortgage. They'll each rent for $1,850 a month. I'm assuming a 5% vacancy, 3% annual appreciation, 3% rent growth, a 25% effective tax rate. Yes, for property management, 8%. Monthly maintenance and monthly reserves for repairs and maintenance, 5%. $299 in HOAs times two, so $598 a month. Annual real estate taxes, they're about $1,000, $1,050 over there in a lot of these areas, so about $2,100 a year in taxes. Double the insurance, about $700. So I might be off by a few dollars here and there, but you'll conceptually get the picture. So with all that, that's going to give me a 7.3% cash on cash return and be a 6.6 cap rate. So as far as the Denver market, these are really good numbers. And so those are type of numbers I can expect. And then looking at the bigger picture in using the return on investment quadrant, which talks about the four ways you make money, the returns it assumes on there will be a total of about 25%. and a total of about a $28,000 return the first year. And that's across both properties. So the cash flow for both will be about $8,200. My depreciation benefit will be about $3,100. My debt pay down will be about $4,800. And my appreciation will be about $12,000. So altogether, a $28,000 return or about a 25% return on my money. So appreciation is about 10% of that. So I'm using a 3% appreciation, which I think is very modest for Denver right now, and especially modest for these lower priced units. Just because there's so few of them, I would expect to see good appreciation in those properties. So if you take appreciation away, that's going to give me about a 15% return on my money. 15% is greater than 3.75%. And then my total cash would be about $16,000 in total return between cash flow, depreciation, and debt pay down. Well, I'm happy with both those numbers, whether I get appreciation or whether I don't get appreciation. So let's compare these numbers to what I'm now paying on my new higher mortgage. So my mortgage is an extra $480 a month, and that works out to be $5,760 a year. The cash flow from these two condos before taxes is going to be $8,191. So that's about a $2,400 more a year in the spread between the rental cash flow and the mortgage cash flow. Great. So if I can see the cash flow greater, I definitely want to see it. Okay, it's not a hard and fast rule for me, but I definitely would like it. So that's a win. I have an estimated 25% return on my money. So that's a win. And conservatively, if there's no appreciation, I'll be around a 15% return on my money. And that's a win. And secondly, don't forget about depreciation, which will be, it should be about $3,100 a year in benefit for me. Actually, maybe slightly higher, but I'm just assuming 25% tax bracket. So, $3,100 is a little bit more than half of what my new mortgage balance is of that $5,800 a year. So, about half of my new mortgage, the difference in my new mortgage is being paid by the tax depreciation benefits on my rental property. Ooh, that's another win. So, if you put that depreciation benefit in with my cash flow, I'll be making about $5,500 more between, you know, the spread of subtracting those benefits minus my new mortgage payments. Great. So that's another win. I'm happy with that. And so as I think most of you know, I'm much more of a big picture person. I'm not a very short term, get super lost in the details for today. I'm always thinking 5, 10, 20 years out is what I like to focus on. So I think what happens when people look at doing a cash out refinance or a HELOC to go buy new rental properties, people get too hyper-focused on the cash flow difference and what it looks like the very first year. Well, I think you should go beyond cash flow and you should go beyond that first year or two to evaluate the big picture. And that's what I do. So let's just fast forward in 10 years and go slightly into the big picture. So in 10 years, the two condos should return about $82,000 in cumulative cash flow. And this is assuming no rent increases. And this is assuming my, you know, just rents minus all my expenses, minus all my mortgage payments. I'll be making about $82,000 in cumulative cash flow. And I should have $297,000 in equity between the two condos. So that's my down payment. Plus what the property has appreciated at, assuming a 3% appreciation rate, plus the pay down on my loan balance that my tenants are paying for. So altogether, that's about a $400,000 total return just between cash flow and equity and that's not including tax benefits, $400,000 in 10 years. Now, over the same 10 years, I'm going to spend $58,000 approximately. So $480 times 12 months times 10 years gives me that $58,000. So is spending $58,000 to make almost $400,000 a good investment over 10 years? It is in my book, and I'm comfortable with that risk, and I expect to see some type of numbers like this. Now, let's just say you're like, hey, I don't care about the equity, and all you do is you take all your rental profits and simply save it in the bank over this 10 years. So after 10 years, you're gonna have, you should have $82,000, probably a little bit higher, assuming you've been a good landlord and increased your rents. But let's say rents don't increase whatsoever. So now you've got $82,000. Well, is $82,000 enough to go buy another rental property at 20 or 25% down? Yeah, it should be, even though prices will be higher in 10 years. I would still think there will be properties available with that amount of down payment here in Denver, or if not, you can throw in a few dollars. So here's where you start getting that compounding interest effect. So in 10 years, if I've got the discipline, I can just take the cash flow and go out there and buy another rental property. Ooh, well, now I have three rental properties from my initial cash out refinance of $106,000. So what happens if I start evaluating my equity opportunity cost on that almost $300,000? And, you know, it's really hard to say what that is because a lot of it just depends on my situation in 10 years. I might still be in the accumulation phase. I might be in the debt pay down phase. I don't know. I might be somewhere in between. So a lot of it depends on me as the investor. And then also a lot of it just depends on what the market conditions are like, interest rate conditions, which are, you know, I have no crystal ball. And also just depends on what the property is doing. Is that property in 10 years still a great rental unit? Or does it do what happened to my condo in Reno where, great, I saw huge equity gains, but the rents didn't keep up and now it's not a great performing rental property. So that might dictate, you know, depending on all this stuff, doing nothing or doing another cash out refinance or selling and doing 1031 to go out there and buy more rental properties. So if I've got $300,000 in equity, let's say I take away some, you know, closing costs on there. Hey, after everything's said and done, let's just say minimal floor, I've got $250,000 to go invest. Well, $250,000 as a down payment on something, I can't do this math in my head, but let's take $250,000 divided by 0.25 down payment. Well, I should be able to do that math in my head now. I can go out there and buy a $1 million property. So perhaps I sell and trade up into a $1 million property. So that might be a 4-unit or a 5 or 6 or 7-unit apartment building here. I don't know. But now I could do the same thing, the same concept I talk about in return equity on what I did with my Reno, Nevada condo and go out there and buy another property. So when you actually stop and look at the big picture of it, I think this is what seals the deal for why doing a cash out refinance can make sense. But of course, to do this, you got to have the discipline to keep high cash reserves and know your numbers and know your comfort zone to make sure it fits your personality profile. And again, I will always be the broken wheel in keeping high cash reserves because as long as you can ride out the bad times and you hold on the properties, you should be pretty wealthy and happier down the road. And then if you just have the discipline to take the cash flow and put it towards buying future rental properties, and then every year you evaluate your equity opportunity cost. And wouldn't it make sense with all the other factors going on, wouldn't it make sense to reposition the equity by a cash out refi, by HELOC, by selling in 1031-ing? You can go out there and really just keep doing that adult monopoly game where you're just trading up and getting more and more properties. And so again, the models I just went through was actually just thinking 10 years out. And this is 10 years into my 30-year loan that I've got to get that $106,000. So what happens if I fast forward another 10 years and another 10 years and I just keep taking that cash flow and buying more properties? Or I, you know, in 10 years, I sold those two condos and bought something better. Then 10 years later, same thing. I sell that next property and buy something bigger and better. Like you can get some really, really impressive, returns. Then this is why I feel confident I can consistently stay above a 10% return. And I think realistically, I can probably stay above a 15% return overall because I'm very much of the mindset that a lot of the properties I buy today, I will not own in 10 years because I will be repositioning the equity. So like I said, I would not mind repeating what I did with my Reno, Nevada condo to go out to sell and buy that, then go buy, you know, four times units, like another fourplex in Westminster. If I do that a few more times, I'll be a happy camper. I should say a happy investor. All right. So just to kind of start wrapping things up, hopefully that gives you insight into why I did it. Hopefully it gives you some different perspective. Because like I said, I just see too many people getting hyper-focused on the cash flow difference and looking at like the year one difference between buying a rental and refinancing their primary residence. However, I think you should go beyond cash flow and go beyond that first year to say, hey, great, if I do this, how much more wealth can I create down the road? Because for a lot of people and a lot of the modeling I've done, you know, a lot of people are sitting on some good equity in their primary residence or their rental properties here in Denver. If you bought, you know, 5 years ago, you probably got some really nice equity on there. So if you go out there and learn this stuff and you make some, you know, calculated moves and you play it smart and safe, you know, this can have a big, big impact on your retirement 20 years, 30 years down the road, because you can take this money and invest it and then keep reinvesting it to keep that compound of interest compounding at a high rate of return for you. So I want you to think about all this stuff. If you've got questions, definitely reach out to me. Leave a comment in the blog post. If you need help crunching these numbers, definitely click on the link or go to the website and go fill out the form for a real estate investing consultation. I'm more than happy to talk to people about this stuff. And this is one of the things that we do with our clients out there, is helping them say, hey, great, here is your current monopoly board. You've got this and this property. You've got this cash flow. You've got this cash saved over here, but you've also got this equity. Great, let's run a couple scenarios and let's discuss some options and discuss pros, cons, and play it out a little bit. And we help you come up with that game plan so you can take what you currently have within your current risk profile and help build a roadmap to get to where you want to go, which is, you know, $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 in cash flow for retirement. So if you got those questions, definitely reach out. I do love talking about this. All right, everyone, thank you so much for listening to this, and I hope you enjoyed this episode and also the investment property analysis course as a whole. I would love to hear feedback on the course, questions you've got, because I want to do more of these courses. I also want to talk a lot more about, you know, maximizing returns from rental properties. So if there's topics that came across as fuzzy or things that I glossed over or new ideas you want to throw in there, reach out to me. I love diving into this stuff and talking about it. All right, have a great day.